Today I'd like to look at Isaiah chapters 13 to 27. Just to pick up what we've done, in chapters 1 to 6 we saw something of the general conditions in Isaiah's time, the conditions which prompted his ministry. Then in chapters 7 to 12 we looked at the era of Ahaz, King Ahaz, and the message that Isaiah brought. We then skipped over and looked at chapters 28 to 39, which covered the era of the following king, Hezekiah. I also mentioned briefly that the final section, chapters 40 to 66, will deal with the era of Babylon. We now come back to pick up the chapters we left out, namely 13 to 27. There are two sections here, 13 to 23, outlining judgments on various nations, and then 24 to 27, which gives us a picture of final judgment and salvation. Now it's the first of those sections I want to look at, namely chapters 13 to 23. There are a whole host of nations mentioned here. The prophecies, if you added them all up in the various nations, would be at least a dozen. Quite clearly we have no time to go in detail through all those dozen or so prophecies. What I've done is divide all of these up into two large categories, and I'm going to then deal with selected nations out of those two categories. The first category are those nations which are concerned with the Assyrian period. Now by the Assyrian period I mean the period that we've looked at in the reign of Ahaz in chapter 7 to 12 and the reign of Hezekiah in chapters 28 to 39. Firstly, the Assyrian period. To eliminate as much confusion as possible, I'm not going to talk about the Ahaz era. The Ahaz era, you'll remember, was when we had this coalition from Israel and Syria invading Judah, and then Ahaz went to Assyria to get help to repel the combined invasion force. I'll skip over that and deal rather with those prophecies that have to do with the Hezekiah era, when Assyria was still the main threat, and Hezekiah was tempted to find allies with all sorts of other people in the hope that he could repel the Assyrian threat. We'll look at three nations which Hezekiah had been tempted to form alliances with: Philistia, Ethiopia, and Egypt. In each case, the temptation was to form an alliance with this country in the hope that he could repel the Assyrian force. Chapter 14, verse 28 through to verse 32 deals with Philistia. To understand all of these prophecies against these different nations, we have to know the political background that we've already dealt with in the previous studies. That's why I did those studies first. The setup here seems to be that as soon as King Ahaz had died and Hezekiah had come to the throne, news pretty soon got around that Hezekiah was very anti-Assyrian. And so all the other anti-Assyrian types came trying to form alliances with Hezekiah. And we have one deputation that arrives from Philistia. Philistia was just this area down here on the coast of Canaan, what today we would call the Gaza Strip. And so some people come from Philistia to approach the new king Hezekiah and put to him the proposition that they get together and form some sort of an alliance which hopefully would be able to withstand the Assyrians. The reason for it was that apparently Assyria had just suffered some sort of setback, and Philistia, being very opportunist, came to ask Judah to join forces, and now God's message comes through Isaiah to the leader of Judah, saying, don't be party to this sort of thing. Verse 28, in the year that King Ahaz died, that is the year that Hezekiah became king, we have this oracle: rejoice not, O Philistia, all of you, that the rod which smote you is broken. That's a reference to the fact that Assyria had just suffered some sort of setback, because from the serpent's root will come forth an adder, and its fruit will be a flying serpent. In other words, Assyria will revive, and it will come back more ferocious than it was previously. And it goes on in verses 30 and 31 to speak of some of the devastation that will result. So what then are we to say to these messengers that have come from Philistia proposing the cooperation? Verse 32, what will one answer the messengers of the nation, the messengers of Philistia which have come? This is what they'll answer: the Lord has founded Zion, and in her the afflicted of his people find refuge. Now you've seen that before. You've seen that in the references to the reign of Ahaz. We saw it in the references to the reign of Hezekiah. Trust in the Lord, trust in Mount Zion, faith in God. This is the way to victory. They must refuse all these offered alliances. So much for Philistia. The second one I want to look at is Ethiopia in chapter 18. Ethiopia is, of course, in northern Africa, and you have a good National Geographic sort of description here in the opening verses of the land of Ethiopia, a place of whirring wings, all sorts of buzzing insects. It's beyond the rivers of Ethiopia. It sends ambassadors by the Nile in vessels of papyrus upon the waters. So you have the picture of ambassadors or representatives coming from Ethiopia, sailing their papyrus canoes down the Nile to the mouth, and then coming overland up to Jerusalem to approach Hezekiah with this suggestion that again they could get together and form some sort of an alliance to resist Assyria. Again, the message of Isaiah is, go home, we won't cooperate. Go, second half of verse 2, you swift messengers, to a nation tall and smooth. This is a reference to these tall Negro people of Africa. A people feared far and near. They were of large stature, and the folks around Palestine tended to fear the Negro races of Africa. Go back to these people, to a nation mighty and conquering, whose land the rivers divide, a reference to the fact that the Nile and its tributaries cut right through the center of Ethiopia, or if you like, Sudan. Same message as the previous one. Now, while we're on it, you'll find from verses 3 to 6 is a description of how the Assyrian army may indeed come close to Jerusalem, but right at the height of their power, when they expect to get the victory, God will cut them down. Here, again, you have poetic references to the narratives that we saw previously. Verse 3, all you inhabitants of the world, you who dwell on the earth, when a signal is raised on the mountains, look. When a trumpet is blown, hear. Thus says the Lord. I will quietly look from my dwelling like clear heat in sunshine, like a cloud of dew in the heat of harvest. For before the harvest, when the blossom is over and the flower becomes a ripening grape, he will cut off the shoots with pruning hooks, and the spreading branches he will hew away. Now what's all that mean? It means that God is quietly watching. The Assyrians are building up their attack. You have the references in verse 3 there to the signalling, probably signalling for the final attack on Jerusalem. All the blowing of trumpets and the general preparations for an invasion. And God is just sitting quietly by, as quiet as dew, as silent as sunshine. He is looking down, and then when the moment comes, he reaps the harvest. He comes in with his pruning hook and he chops them all down, and that's the finish of them. A very common picture in the Bible of judgment being likened to a great harvest. He cuts off the shoots with his pruning hooks, and that's the end of them. Verse 6, the invading army is all left to the birds of prey of the mountains and to the beasts of the earth. So they provide good food for all the flesh-eating birds and animals around the place. And the birds of prey will summer upon them, and the beasts of the earth will winter upon them. Picture of the carnage on the battlefield after the invaders have been decimated. But the point is this, why must you make an alliance with another nation? God is going to protect you. If you trust in him, God will bring you the victory. If, of course, you trust in an alliance, you won't get the victory. And after God has demonstrated his response to your faith in giving you the victory, then you'll realize that he was right. And even the Ethiopians then will realize that you were right in not making the alliance. The Ethiopians, too, will be convinced that God is to be trusted. Then in verse 7, at that time, gifts will be brought to the Lord of hosts. So we have a picture now of the ambassadors from Ethiopia coming back to Jerusalem. The first time they came to Jerusalem in verse 1 was to propose an alliance. Judah was to refuse. And now in verse 7, the picture is of these ambassadors coming back to Jerusalem, this time to acknowledge that God is the victor and to bring him fitting worship and thanks. So in verse 7, at that time, gifts will be brought to the Lord of hosts from a people tall and smooth, from a people feared near and far, a nation mighty and conquering whose land the rivers divide, and these gifts will be brought to Mount Zion, the place of the name of the Lord of hosts. Do you remember again, it's in Mount Zion that you trust, the great stone, the cornerstone, the waters of Shiloh. In every one of these messages it goes back to Mount Zion, which is the symbol of God, in God we trust. The application to us, I think, is fairly obvious here. I don't have to labour this point, that as we see these things, we can see what God is doing, and we can see the faith which he requires, and that if we opt for an alternative way, in the end it brings disaster. Now the third reference is in chapter 19, and that's to Egypt. Because Egypt was the nation that Hezekiah was most tempted to lean upon. And of course he was told that he was wasting his time trusting in Egypt. Well, here in chapter 19, we have an oracle concerning Egypt. If Judah is tempted to rely upon Egypt, let Judah realize right from the outset that it is a futile exercise. Behold, the Lord is coming on a swift cloud and comes to Egypt, and nothing is going to save Egypt. In verse 1, the idols of Egypt won't save Egypt from God's judgment, and the hearts of the Egyptians will melt within them. In verse 2, the armies of Egypt won't save Egypt from judgment, because there's going to be civil war, Egyptians fighting Egyptians, general chaos in the kingdom. Verse 3, their sorcerers and their mediums and their wizards, their astrologers, these people won't be able to save Egypt, because God again is going to confound their plans, and when they consult all these idols, sorcerers, mediums and wizards, they'll find that God doesn't hear them, but rather in verse 4 gives them over into the hand of a hard master. We find then that the Nile will dry up, and once the Nile has dried up, that's the end of Egypt's lifeblood, you might say. In verse 5, the waters of the Nile will be dried up, and the river will be parched and dry, and its canals will become foul. Reeds and rushes will rot away. Of course, Egypt without reeds and rushes is like the Chinese without bamboo. Half of the things that you normally do, you can't do anymore because one of your basic commodities is gone. And in verse 7, farming becomes impossible because there are all bare places instead of well-watered places, and all that is sown by the Nile will dry up, be driven away, and be no more. So farming falls into chaos. In verse 8, the fishermen, they mourn and lament because there are no fish in the sea, and so their living has been lost, and they languish. In verse 9, the factory workers, the weavers of cotton, the people who work in combed flax, they're all in despair too. And then in verse 10, those who are pillars of the land will be crushed, and all who work for hire will be grieved, which is another way of saying there will be widespread unemployment. So there are the three countries, Philistia, Ethiopia, and Egypt. And in each case, the prophet paints a picture saying it is absolutely hopeless to form an alliance or to trust in any of these nations. We come now to the fourth section in chapter 20, and that ties together these three nations, Philistia, Ethiopia, and Egypt. If you notice in verse 1, there's a reference there to Ashdod, and Ashdod was one of the five cities of the Philistines. And if you just cast your eye down to the end of verse 3, you'll see the reference there to Egypt and Ethiopia. Chapter 20 is a very odd chapter, and it has the story here of how Isaiah acted a prophecy. Now, you know that these prophets were rather oddball types. Ezekiel, you know some of his acted messages, and Isaiah and Jeremiah, they certainly did strange things. Isaiah did something strange here. What he did was to walk naked and barefoot around Jerusalem for 3 years. He should be in the Guinness Book of Records, the world's longest streak. It's certainly a pretty odd thing to do, you'd have to admit. Mind you, I'm not sure that we should take the word naked literally. People in the East very rarely go stark naked. They normally have some sort of flimsy loincloth. They bath in the open air, and even if they're not in the open air, they still seem to be very hesitant to get all their clothes off. Naked quite frequently doesn't have quite the full meaning that we would understand it to have. But what Isaiah was doing, I think, was walking around in some sort of very flimsy loincloth, barefooted, with his buttocks exposed, demonstrating to the people that this is what's going to happen to them. That's what they did to captives when they took them off into captivity, stripped them down to the bare essentials, and then they chained them all together, and away they went off. Isaiah had been preaching to these people and saying, look, you folks, that's what's going to happen to you people. It's no good trusting in alliances with Egypt or with Ethiopia or with Philistia or with anybody else who comes along. That's not going to save you. If you people don't repent, you're all going to go into captivity. And those nations that you think you're trusting in, they're all going to go into captivity too. They wouldn't take any notice of him, of course. So Isaiah thought, well, I'll find a novel way of getting the message across. And you have to admit that he was fairly original in coming up with this way of demonstrating his message. And so for 3 years, that's the way he marched around. I'm not suggesting that he got around like that all day, every day. I would think that, like Ezekiel, what he did was to carry on this pantomime maybe for an hour and a half, say, every morning. He'd go around through the streets of the city. And they'd all say, oh, here he comes again. And so day after day this would happen. Well, it's one way of getting a point across. In the year that the commander-in-chief, who was sent by Sargon, the king of Assyria, came to Ashdod and fought against it and took it, Ashdod, the Philistines, they fall into Assyria. At that time, the Lord in verse 2 had spoken by Isaiah the son of Amos, saying, "Go and loose the sackcloth from off your loins, take off your shoes from your feet," and he had done so, walking naked and barefoot. And the Lord said in verse 3, "As my servant Isaiah has walked naked and barefoot for 3 years, as a sign and a portent against Egypt and Ethiopia," and get the picture here, this is what's going to happen to the Egyptians and the Ethiopians. They're going to be conquered by Assyria, so don't trust in them. And don't trust in Philistia, because already in this message Philistia has fallen. So in verse 4, "Shall the king of Assyria lead away the Egyptians captive and the Ethiopians exiles, both the young and the old, naked and barefoot, with buttocks uncovered, to the shame of Egypt. Then they shall be dismayed and confounded because of Ethiopia their hope and of Egypt their boast." That is, the people of Judah, of Jerusalem, who wanted to trust in these nations, then they'll realize that they had based their hopes falsely. "And the inhabitants of this coastland will say in that day," this coastland could be a reference to the people of Palestine being either the people of Judah or perhaps even the Philistines, because they also were on the coast there. "The inhabitants of this coastland will say in that day, 'Behold, this is what has happened to those in whom we hoped and to whom we fled for help to be delivered from the king of Assyria. And we, how shall we escape?'" Get the message? Very graphic. That's what's happened to them. We had hoped in them. Goodness me, if they get carted off into captivity like that, what hope is there for us? All right, I hope that those four brief sections make some more sense to us. If you read them cold, you sometimes wonder what on earth they're on about. But once you see them in the context of the historical sections that we've considered previously, they take on a bit more meaning. Now can we go back, please, to chapter 13? I want now to look at the judgment on Babylon. Once again, can I fill you in on some of the historical details? If we move on after the period of Isaiah, we find that Assyria in due course began to decline, and eventually it was conquered by Babylon. Babylon pretty soon asserted itself, conquered Judah, in due course destroyed Jerusalem, and carried off all the people of Judah into captivity in Babylon, and that was the end of the nation Judah. The Babylonians kept the people in captivity for, let us say, approximately 70 years. And at the end of those 70 years, God then raised up the Persians to conquer the Babylonians and so release the Jews and allow the Jews to come back to their land. Babylon is known for its pride. Time and again we've noticed concerning Assyria the word arrogance. God punished the Assyrians for their arrogance. And as you read about Babylon, you find the same word, and particularly the word pride. Babylon committed the same error as had Assyria. They thought that because they had conquered these people, they could do as they like. And God has to say to them, "Look, you only conquer them by my permission. And you don't have an absolute mandate to do to my people as you like. I might use you to chastise them, but you just can't go ahead and treat them this way and get away with it." So an oracle is announced against Babylon. So we look ahead now in advance of the period we've just been considering, and we look ahead to the Babylonian era, and we must picture now the people of Israel in captivity, or the people of Judah rather, in captivity in Babylon, and the Babylonians now about to get their deserts. The nation, as I mentioned, which God used to conquer Babylon was the nation Persia, or if you like, Medo-Persia, the ancient empire of Media combined with the ancient empire of Persia, under the leadership of a man called Cyrus, whom we're going to meet next study. In the opening 5 verses of chapter 13, you have again the very colourful picture painted of how Medo-Persia prepares for battle. "On a bare hill, raise a signal, cry aloud to them, wave the hand for them to enter the gates of the nobles. I myself have commanded my consecrated ones." That's God speaking. God, in other words, says, "I have raised up the Medo-Persian army. I have summoned these people, my mighty men, to execute my anger. I am now going to use the Medo-Persian people to carry out my judgment upon Babylon." Verse 4 pictures the tumult on the mountains. The armies getting ready and rushing around and screeching and doing all the sorts of things that bloodthirsty soldiers like to do as they psych themselves up for the battle. There's an uproar of kingdoms as nations gather together. But the last line of verse 4 tells us that it's really God who is preparing his hosts for battle. He is going to use these people to squash the Babylonians. They come from a distant land, from the ends of the heavens, and the Lord and the weapons of his indignation to destroy the whole earth. Well, when the Babylonians realize that the Medo-Persians are coming to attack them, they start to shake with fear. It's interesting to see how all these nations, one by one, reach the top, and then they get what they gave others. The Assyrians walked all over everybody, and in the end the Babylonians walked all over them. Well, then the Babylonians walked all over everybody, and now they're going to get walked over likewise by the Persians. What we sow, inevitably, we reap. In verse 6, wail, for the day of the Lord is near. The day of the Lord is an expression which refers to any great intervention of God in judgment. There were many days of the Lord in Old Testament times, the flood of Noah, the destruction of Jerusalem, the destruction of Babylon, of Edom, and various other nations. Sometimes even a locust plague was referred to as a day of the Lord, a day of God's intervention in judgment. And of course, the great day of the Lord will be the final great intervention at the end of the age. Anyway, the day of the Lord is near as far as the Babylonians are concerned, and it's coming from the Almighty. Verse 7, all hands will be feeble and every man's heart will melt. It goes on then describing their pains and their agonies. We won't go into all the details here. The chief point that comes through in verses 9 to 13 is that the reason for God's punishment of Babylon is its pride, referred to very well there in verse 11. I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will put an end to the pride of the arrogant and lay low the haughtiness of the ruthless. If there's one sin which God repeatedly is said to hate, it is this sin of pride. As you move on then down to verses 14 to 16, we find the enemy invading, and when they invade, they show no mercy to the Babylonians. And you have some of the gory pictures there, as for example in verse 16, of how the invaders will smash the infants to pieces and dash them upon rocks and generally pulverize the innocent. Pretty gruesome people in ancient times. We, of course, have more sophisticated ways today of getting rid of the enemy, but the end result is still the same. You kill them. Verses 17 to 22 tells us how that the Babylonians try to buy off the Medes and the Persians. In ancient times, a lot of warfare was carried out simply as a way of getting economic profit. We tend to do it today through trade and other means. Well, of course, they had that in ancient times. But very often they simply went to war to plunder, to enrich the state's treasury. So you'd come with your armies and besiege a city and then make a demand for payment. It's blackmail, that's all it is. Then the people in the city hand over the payment, and so the invading army goes away. And this way you escape any battle. Your treasury is broke, and the invaders have left. Well, here we have a picture of the Medes and the Persians invading Babylon, and the Babylonians trying to bribe them to get them off. But the Medes and the Persians are not going to be bribed. They're determined to crush Babylon. They're not after money only. They are after power as well, and they want to bring Babylon to its knees. So in verse 17, we have the picture of God stirring up the Medes against the Babylonians, and it says that the Medes have no regard for silver, and they do not delight in gold. So it's no sense trying to pay them off. Rather, in verse 18, they're intent upon destruction, and their bows will slaughter the young men, and they'll have no mercy on the fruit of the womb. Verse 19, Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the splendor and pride, there it is again, the pride of the Chaldeans, will in the end be like Sodom and Gomorrah, completely overthrown. So much for chapter 13. We come to chapter 14, and here we have another description of the overthrow of Babylon. In chapter 13, you might say the reason for the overthrow of Babylon was the nation's pride. In chapter 14, the reason for the overthrow of Babylon is given from a different angle, and the reason here is that God is using this as the means of releasing his people. As long as the Babylonians had control, the Jews would never be released. So what God has to do is to get somebody else in control of the Jews. And that somebody else happens to be the Medes and the Persians. So he's going to get them to conquer the Babylonians, and you'll find as you move on that as soon as the Medes and the Persians have conquered the Babylonians, the first thing the new king does is to grant a general freedom to all the slaves of other nations who had been held captive by Babylon. That's a reason then why God is using the Medes and the Persians to conquer Babylon, and that's outlined in the opening couple of verses of chapter 14. The Lord will have compassion on Jacob. He will again choose Israel. He will set them in their own land. He'll bring them back from their captivity. And to do that, he has to destroy the power of Babylon. In verse 2, the people will take them and bring them to their place, and the house of Israel will possess them in the Lord's land as male and female slaves, and they will take captives those that were their captors. So the tables are going to be turned. The Israelites are to be freed, and those who held them captive will now become the captives. Verse 3 following introduces us then to a taunt song which was sung over the fallen king of Babylon. The king embodied all of Babylon's evil, all of Babylon's pride. Now the king is dead, and the Jews and all the other people who had been oppressed by him rejoice. If you just think for a moment of some of the stories of the king of Babylon that you get in the opening chapters of Daniel, is not this great Babylon which I have built? And the pride of the man, Nebuchadnezzar. Well, Nebuchadnezzar wasn't the last king. In fact, the last king was Belshazzar. But you know the pictures there, how the man was so proud and arrogant, and in the end God had to make him go in the field and eat grass like an animal to show him that the heavens rule, that God is in control, and to punish the pride and arrogance of Babylon. Well, here you have it again. Now, I know that some of the verses here in chapter 14 have been taken and applied differently, but again, our first responsibility is to interpret these verses in the context of the person concerning whom they were written. And it says very clearly in verse 4 that you will take up this taunt song against the king of Babylon. So we're talking here about the king of Babylon. How the oppressor has ceased, the insolent fury ceased. Haha, he's finished now. The Lord has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of rulers. He's broken the power of Babylon, that in previous times, verse 6, smote the peoples in wrath with unceasing blows, that ruled the nations in anger with unrelenting persecution. This Babylon that was a real brute, the way it persecuted the nations and ruled them so ruthlessly, now it has fallen. And the whole earth, in verse 7, is at rest and quiet. And in fact, they break forth in singing, because Babylon, the previous monster, has now been smashed. In verse 8, the cypresses rejoice and sing songs together, the cedars of Lebanon. They all clap their hands for joy, and they say, since you were laid low, no hewer comes up against us. Nobody comes up chopping down the forests to get trees for their siege warfare and all the other uses they were put to in the great war machine of Babylon. And then we have a very ghoulish picture in verses 9 and 10, as Sheol is stirred up to meet the king of Babylon when he comes. Now, if it's not you that's concerned here, I guess you can smile a little bit as you see the picture that's painted for us. Sheol is, of course, the world of the dead. People in Old Testament times didn't have the clearly defined differences of heaven and hell and the New Testament developments we meet later on. They had this vague, shadowy world of the dead called Sheol. We have this picture of skeletons and bones lying around there, and they're welcoming this king of Babylon. He used to have a golden crown on his head and fancy clothes and strut around the place, and now he's come down into Sheol. And Sheol is stirred up to meet you when you come. It rouses the shades to greet you. You have to make some noises here. All who were leaders of the earth, it raises from their thrones all who were kings of the nations, and all of them now they will speak and they will say to you, you too have become as weak as we. You have to picture these people welcoming the king. You have become like us. Your pomp is brought down to Sheol, the sound of your harps. Maggots are the bed beneath you, and worms are your covering. How are you fallen from heaven, O Daystar, son of dawn? How are you cut down to the ground, you who laid the nations low, one after the other? You conquered the nations, and you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. Above the stars to God, I will set my throne on high. I will sit in the Mount of Assembly in the far north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I'll make myself like the Most High. Well, typified, of course, in the stories of Nebuchadnezzar in the book of Daniel. You were proud, you were ambitious, you sought the highest place. You craved for the greatest honor, the greatest power, and now you are brought down to the lowest place. The greatest shame, complete weakness. Verse 15, you are brought down to Sheol, to the depths of the pit. And those who see you will stare at you and ponder over you, and they'll say, is this the man who made the earth tremble? Is this the king of Babylon? We all shook before him. He was a powerful man. He shook kingdoms. He made the world like a desert and overthrew its cities. And he wouldn't let his prisoners go home. There's the little barb in the tale. The prisoners held captive, the Jews, they're held captive under Babylon, and Babylon wouldn't release them. God wants to release them. And in order to release his people, God has to squash Babylon. And now we have this picture of the king of Babylon reduced to this shameful condition. Verse 18, all the kings of the nations lie in glory, each in his own tomb. You know how the kings in ancient times made very fancy tombs for themselves. And all those kings lay in splendor and glory in their tombs. But verse 19, but you, king of Babylon, you are cast out, away from your sepulcher, like a loathed, untimely birth, clothed with the slain, those pierced by the sword who go down to the stones of the pit, like a dead body trodden underfoot. You will not be joined with them in burial, because you have destroyed your land and you have slain your people. Well, there's the king of Babylon, cut down to size well and truly. Now there's a third reference I want to make here to Babylon, and that's in chapter 21. We're told in the first verse of chapter 21 that this oracle concerns the wilderness of the sea, and as you read through, you find that the wilderness of the sea is in fact a name for Babylon. In verse 2, a stern vision is told to me, the plunderer plunders, and the destroyer destroys. And here we have a picture again of Persia and Media going up to destroy Babylon. In verse 2 it mentions Elam, and Elam is of course the ancient name for Persia, just as Chaldea is an ancient name for Babylon. Go up, O Elam, lay siege, O Media. All the sighing she has caused I bring to an end. All the sighing and the suffering that Babylon has caused, God is now going to bring to an end. Remember how Isaiah has longed for the freedom of God's people. But there's no sense of crowing over the vanquished. There's no vindictiveness in Isaiah. He had longed for the day when Israel would be free, when Judah would be free, when the Jews would go home, when Babylon would be overthrown. But now as he sees the vision of this terrible judgment upon Babylon, he's not licking his chops. In fact, he says in verse 3 that his loins are filled with anguish and pangs have seized me like the pangs of a woman in travail. I am bowed down so that I cannot hear. I am dismayed so that I cannot see. My mind reels. Horror has appalled me. The twilight I longed for has been turned for me into trembling. I long for this day, this new age when the captivity would be over and the people would go home. But now that I see the horror and the atrocities of that day, he doesn't get any pleasure out of seeing Babylon minced up. And he says this twilight has been turned into a time of trembling. What's referred to here in chapter 21 is the same story that you get in Daniel chapter 5. Now we all know the story of Daniel 5, how Belshazzar was holding a great feast. And you have the hand that wrote mysteriously on the wall, your days are up. You've been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Your kingdom is to be divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. They were having a great feast, and right in the middle of the feast, the attack came. And that night Belshazzar was slain, and the Medes and the Persians took the kingdom. That's what's referred to here in this small prophecy. In verse 5, we have the picture of Belshazzar and his people eating, preparing the table and spreading the rugs and having themselves a great big banquet. They eat, they drink, they fill themselves with all the best things, and right in the middle of the feast comes this cry, arise, O princes, oil the shield. Right in the middle of the feast, the enemy attacks. And then in verses 6 following, you have a picture which Isaiah sees as a watchman is sent to Babylon to report on what he sees there. Now this, I don't know where to picture the prophet as being when he wrote this, but somehow he pictures a messenger going out to Babylon to report what he sees. So in verse 6, the Lord said to me, go set a watchman and let him announce what he sees. When he sees riders, horsemen in pairs, riders on asses, riders on camels, let him listen diligently, very diligently. Verse 8, then he who saw cried, that is the man who was sent as the watchman, the forward scout, call him what you like, he said, upon a watchtower I stand, O Lord, day by day, continually. At my post I'm stationed, hold nights. I'm here, looking, to see what's going to happen to Babylon. What does he see? What he sees is the Medo-Persian Empire approaching Babylon, and the end of Babylon has come. So in verse 9, he says, this is what I see. Here come riders, horsemen in pairs. And he answered, fallen, fallen is Babylon, and all the images of her gods he has shattered to the ground. Babylon's time of destruction has come. And in verse 10, Judah, my threshed and winnowed one that has suffered, is now released. And so they get the good news announced to them. Well, there we have it, a selection from the major eras of this part of biblical history. We've jumped around a bit, but I trust that gives you the general setting. Now, if you go back to the beginning of chapter 13, in about 2 minutes, I'll run very quickly through the whole of this section, and we'll just fill in some of the details. I'm not going to give you any more exposition of these sections. Chapters 13 and 14, down to verse 23, deal with Babylon, and we've already talked about that. Chapter 14, verse 24 to 27, talks about Assyria, and we've already talked quite a bit about Assyria. And then the last part of chapter 14, Philistia, we dealt with. Chapters 15 and 16 deal with Moab. I haven't touched on that one at all. Chapter 17 deals with the time of Ahaz, going back to our second study when Syria and Israel combined to attack Jerusalem. This is an oracle, chapter 17, concerning that period and showing how Damascus, the capital of Syria, and Samaria, the capital of Israel, are to be destroyed, but God will deliver Jerusalem. You find the names mentioned there in verse 1, Damascus. In verse 3, again, Ephraim, of course, the northern kingdom Israel. Damascus, again, Syria, and so it goes on. But once you know the story of Ahaz and the complicated politics of that era, you'll find chapter 17 falls into place. Chapter 18, we looked at, that was Ethiopia. Chapter 19, we looked at, that was Egypt. Chapter 20, we looked at that also, concerning Judah. Chapter 21, we've seen most of that concerning Babylon, except verses 11 and 12, which are a short oracle against Edom, and verses 13 to 17, a short oracle concerning some of the Arab tribes. Chapter 22 concerns Judah, and this again has to do with the great deliverance when God saved Judah from the Assyrian siege. Remember what we saw last study in chapters 28 to 39, when Assyria besieged Jerusalem and God miraculously delivered Jerusalem. Well, chapter 22 is a very colourful account of that siege, when it looked as if Jerusalem was to be crushed and then miraculously God delivered it. And you'll find towards the end of the chapter, two people are mentioned that we met in our previous study, namely Eliakim and Shebna. A little narrative there that you can follow through. It's rather amusing, some of the politics of the upper echelons of Jerusalem's power structure. Chapter 23 deals with Phoenicia and announces God's judgment on Phoenicia. Phoenicia was the great trading nation on the Mediterranean coast immediately to the north of Israel. Well, that covers those chapters, and then chapters 24 to 27 are pictures of final judgment and salvation, which are very, very typical of the sort of literature you get right through the prophets. You've seen it all before. I'll leave it for now, because we are going to see some of it when we come to the final section, chapters 40 to 66. And we'll pick up at chapter 40 in our next study. And from there on, we'll move straight through in four studies to the end of the book.